Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, this is Misha Tate, and you're listening to Carson's Corner.
This is Stitch Duran, and you're listening to Carson's Corner. Make sure you stay tuned in.
This is Justin Ray Harvey, Frank Duke's student. You're listening to the best of the best shows on the web and beyond. Carson's Corner with Bob Carson.
This is Bo, the one-man army Taylor, media darling and Midwest champion of the world. You're listening to the only radio show that's hard-hitting, keeps it real, and does not pull punches. Carson's Corner.
This is the coach, Sean Tompkins, and you're listening to the best in mixed martial arts, Carson's Corner.
Okay, let's go. Yeah, g'day, this is Justin Lawrence calling from my backyard in Australia, mate. You're listening to Bob Carson, the finest investigative journalist in mixed martial arts history. Listen to his show. I love it.
Hey, this is Joey Odessa, and you're listening to me on the Bob Carson Show, the show that lets no words barred give a whole new perspective to no holds barred.
These days, it's not much fun at Bally's and Caesars in Atlantic City. The CEO is playing the corporate greed game, cutting dealers' hours, cutting retirement and health benefits, even breaking the law by refusing to bargain. Yet he paid himself $39 million last year, with plenty of perks.
Place your bet.
When Bally's and Caesars play games with casino dealers, it's not fun for anybody. And everybody loses. That's why the UAW Atlantic City Dealers Union paid for this time.
Welcome to another edition of Carson's Corner here in the new year, 2016. I wish everybody a happy new year. Glad you could be with us here on Carson's Corner. I want to welcome the folks over at the Underground Forum. Thank you very much for listening. We also have the chat room open for you if you want to chime in there. And if you want to give us a call, you can, 347-326-9749. That is 347-326-9749. Very, very pleased to have our guest here who's already on the line waiting to speak with us. I have been intrigued with him for a long time because, you know, this was really the old school era of MMA, the UFC. And I remember watching the videotapes and watching, you know, the different fighters from that era. And I remember seeing Harry Moskowitz. And at that time, I was, you know, 15, 16. I was looking to train MMA, looking to get into the sport. There wasn't any jiu-jitsu schools around New Jersey where I was. I mean, there wasn't really any anywhere. I mean, because the sport was in the dark ages back then. But I really wanted to fight. And I remember saying to myself, wow, you know, this guy, would I want to step in the cage with the Harry Moskowitz? You know, the guy's 6'5", 275 pounds. He's agile. You know, he's a brawler. And I just was really intrigued with him and a number of fighters, really, from that era. Don Fry, I was really intrigued by. And so, you know, I got to become friends with Harry on Facebook. And I said, let me invite Harry on the show. And so we could catch up with him and we could find out, you know, what's going on and find out really about his career. We can explore his MMA career in depth. So it's 2016, and I'm happy to welcome old school, no holds barred fighter, UFC veteran, and MMA pioneer to the show, Mr. Harry Moskowitz, Dirty Harry Moskowitz. Harry, welcome to Carson's Corner.
How you doing, Bob? Good, very good to be here.
Thank you for calling. Really appreciate it. And I hope you had a happy new year.
Oh, I definitely did. Definitely did. Safe and happy.
Yeah, that's very, very important. What was your focus, or what is your focus going to be on 2016?
My focus is since I got away from the fight game, I got lazy, got old, and my focus is I'm trying to get myself back in shape, just for me and for my family, and just to have a safe and happy and healthier New Year.
Yeah, I'm in that same position. I mean, I fought MMA years ago, not nearly as much as you did, but I've really, over the past, you know, 10, 15 years since I've been inactive, I've kind of had difficulty getting back in the shape. So I'm definitely kind of in the same boat as you are. And you're a name that a lot of people know from your extensive fighting career. I'm not sure fans know the man behind the nickname Dirty Harry. I mean, at least not the MMA version. But let's talk a bit about how you became involved in the sport. You know, I know your official fight record stretches back to about 1996. Is that accurate to say when you made your first debut?
Yeah, it was around right around 96, 95, 96. My first fight was in Biloxi, Mississippi. So, yeah, it was around 96.
Now, when you started fighting, we were still in the style versus style phase. I mean, what was your style and fighting background coming into the cage in the mid-90s?
Back then, I had been I had gone to a school. I wanted to be a professional wrestler, and I'd gone to school for about 2 years. I had a trainer named Iron Mike Sharp. He was a professional wrestler back then, and
yeah.
he come to me and told me that my aggression, when I got hit the wrong way, I got mad. He told me that I would never make it in the sport of professional wrestling, that he recommended I go somewhere else because I got mad and wanted to fight, and they frowned upon it with professional wrestling.
Yeah, Iron Mike Sharp is a guy that I believe, if I'm not mistaken, he used to have a school out here in New Jersey. I know I used to hear a lot about him training wrestlers over in this area, and he seems like a really, really tough guy.
Yeah, he had a school in Bricktown, New Jersey, that I attended. He was a really tough guy. It was very hardcore training.
Right.
But, I mean, as everybody knows, professional wrestling is staged, it's choreographed, and I didn't like getting hit the wrong way, and I'd get me an attitude. So he recommended that I go the other way, and, I mean, for years, I never pursued it. I moved from New Jersey down to the Mississippi Gulf Coast, and I just happened to be, I was a bar bouncer down here and happened to meet up with a promoter in the nightclub I was working at. They were having a local fight here. And I met with a promoter named Buddy Albin. He ran the IFC, the International Fighting Championship, and talked with him, and 3 days later I was in a cage.
That's pretty awesome. So basically after you were at Iron Mike Sharp's school, you went to work as a bouncer. Did you have any martial arts training at that point, or you just went right in?
I had trained martial arts as a child in Kingsburg, New Jersey, under a guy named Buddy Amato. But as far as a formal training, jiu-jitsu and that, no, I had none. I was a brawler, and Buddy Albin gave me my shot. Once I got into it, I hooked up with a guy named John Dixon, who had fought in a Pride mat, and
right.
I trained under him with jiu-jitsu and different styles of ground fighting.
Yeah, you know, with your size, you seem like one of those people who may have been involved in physical altercations before you became a professional fighter. And big guys always seem to get roped into fighting. I mean, did you have a lot of street fighting experience?
I had an extensive amount of street fighting. I grew up on the Jersey Shore in Highlands, New Jersey. And the police there were very... I was a regular with them for fighting and just different altercations, yes.
Yeah, it's like, you know, it reminds me of another guy that was fairly well-known, Bam Bam Bigelow, who grew up in this area. And, you know, the stories that emerged from Bam Bam, who passed away a few years ago, and his fights are kind of legendary. So I can almost, when you talk about this, I almost kind of think of what I've heard and what I've seen of Bam Bam, who also grew up on the Jersey Shore. I believe he grew up in Asbury Park, so.
Yes. My sister actually attended high him in Asbury Park. And as you say, he was a very tough man, big man, but he graduated from Asbury Park High School.
Now, I'd love to hear some Dirty Harry Moskowitz Street fighting stories. I mean, any one in particular that sticks out in mind?
Me and my, as a teenager in New Jersey, me and my father, there was a local newspaper called the Courier.
Uh-huh.
And I don't even know if it's still around, but me and my father and a kid I grew up in Highlands with, his name was Frank, him and his father, we made the front page of the newspaper. Me and Frank had gotten into an altercation while it was going on. His father pulled up, jumped out of the car, and he had a baseball bat. He threw Frank a chain, and they were both going to beat me. And it just so happened my dad was on his way to the store to get milk.
Right.
And saw what was going on, pulled over. He jumped out of the car, and we had traffic. The Highlands is a small town. It's about 1 square mile. We had the main road in town blocked. It was all shut down with us fighting in the middle of the street, and it just happened to be a reporter in the traffic who got out and was taking pictures. And we made the made the front page of the local paper. It said the Hatfields and the McCoys are at it again.
Yeah, that's fun. Now, your dad, is he a big guy like you?
He was. My dad was 6 foot. He was only about 190 pounds when I was growing up, but my dad had about a 21-inch arm. He was big up top. He was a very small statured guy, but he was well defined.
Now you're 6'5". What was your ideal fighting weight?
300 pounds. I fluctuated between 275 and 300. I preferred 300.
Yeah. I mean, I know firsthand it could. I was up over 300 pounds, but I'm not nearly as tall as you are. And you mentioned at the beginning, you know, you haven't stayed close to your fighting physique, or have you? Are you around that weight now? Or
right now, I'm at 324 pounds. I'm going. My goal is 275 by April.
Yeah. Because you were listed, I think a lot of your fights you were listed right around 275 in that range, and you come from a time where training and fighting were viewed pretty differently. I think given that a relatively short space of time has passed since then. I mean, what was life like as an NHB fighter in the mid 90s? I mean, we hear so many stories about just the way it was like. I mean, even when I fought years ago. In 2001, it was much, much different. You didn't know who you were fighting. There wasn't a lot of regulation as it is today. And can you give folks at home a sense of it?
Well, as far as the training was, I stayed away from the fighting scene for a while. Stayed away from the gyms, but since I've gotten back around it, I go to some of these gyms. I go to the gym I used to train at, and I watch the way they train. I think. Is it better now? I believe it is a little bit better. But back when I was training, we trained hardcore. There was no, I mean, I got hurt more in the gym than I ever did in a cage. When we were training, it was full out punching, full out kicking. Nothing was pulled. I broke my ribs. I had my face split open, my mouth split open. And today it seems like, I don't know. I think guys are too afraid of getting hurt in the gym, and if you don't get hurt in the gym, you're really going to get hurt in the cage because they don't know what to look for.
Right.
So, I think it's as far as the sport goes, it's evolved a whole lot. I wish the sport would go back to your tournament format, where there's some great champions today. Don't get me wrong. But they pretty much pick and choose who they want to fight. I mean, no, I don't want to fight that guy. I want to fight this. Back when Horace Gracie was there, you had, what, 165, 168-pound man
right.
that was fighting 300-400-pound guys. He never got to pick.
Right.
And I believe in this kind of sport, you should be, I believe, the tournament format was better. Because, like you said, you never knew who you were fighting. You didn't know if you were going to fight once, if you were going to fight three times.
Right.
You had to train. You had to train full out and be prepared for everything. Not Well, I'm only going to fight 15 minutes in one man. That's all I got to be ready for.
Yeah, I agree with you. I really do. And you look at Bellator, and Bellator has tried to revive the tournament format. We recently had the Ryzen fight where you had King Mo Lawal, who fought about three times in two nights. I think he fought twice in one night and another in another night. And then going back a few months ago, he fought twice in one night as well. So I like it. It adds a certain amount of intrigue to the sport. And you can't pick and choose your opponents, and it's very, very exciting. It at home, you just never know how it's going to play out.
Yeah.
Now, what else were you doing for work at the time? My impression is that only a few made a full-time living at that stage in the game.
Yeah, I've been a crane operator for 28 years. I was operating a crane, and then I would get off. I was working 10 to 12 hours a day, get off work, and go to the gym 3-4 hours a night. We were doing that 5 days a week. So, I mean, it was rough. But like I said, back then with NHB, you had to love what you were doing. You had to love the sport.
Right.
In order to be willing to dedicate yourself that much to the training. I have always loved. I love fighting. I love the competition of it. I love pitting myself against another man to see, am I better than him? Have I trained more? Am I stronger? Can I take more? Can I take more punishment?
Yeah.
That's always been my thing.
You know, the atmosphere of those early events were really quite different, you know, from what we see now, as we were talking about, you know, with the banners, the chicken wire fences, plus the fans booing groundwork and yelling obscenities. I mean, it's hard for me to fathom sometimes. Many of our listeners were either children when those fights took place or not even born yet, which seems impossible to me. I mean, nobody could have been born after 1995, and that feels like a few weeks ago for me. But for those people who weren't aware, the UFC at the time, can you put the difference between the polished major sporting events that we see in huge arenas in the days of no holds barred, where many states made the sport illegal and venues were on tribal land or in certain southern states?
I can remember them flying us into Canada and us staying in a motel in Montreal, and then they would put us in a van, take us across the state border and into New York City. Well, not New York City, but upstate New York.
Mm-hmm.
And we would fight and have to get out of the arena, back into the van, and get back across into Canada because we were going to be arrested for doing it because it was illegal in the state. I was supposed to fight in Nashville, Tennessee, and me and my wife went up there. We spent 3 days in a hotel. The night before the event, we were notified that the state police were going to be at the event arresting everybody. The whole event was put off because it wasn't sanctioned there. And I went and fought in Panama City, Florida. And when I walked out into the arena to check I always like to go into the cage to check the surface, make sure everything
right.
was good for me. When I climbed into the cage, it wasn't like your normal cages today. It was somebody. It looked like somebody had taken a fence down in their yard. It was rusted. It was rusted. There was little metal barbs on it. I mean, when you got brushed up against that fence, you were getting cut.
Wow.
It was crazy.
Yeah, I mean, I can imagine even the surface too. Like you know, when I fought in 2004, and again, you know, my career, my MMA career was a joke. I was actually suspended by the Athletic Commission. But before that, I mean, I did unsanctioned matches that, again, you know, we would be shut down if a certain person from the state got wind of what we were doing. Even when I turned pro in 2004. You could feel the depletions in the surface. You know, one area of the cage would be higher than the other area. And I can't imagine what it was like, you know, back in the early days, just how bad the fighting surfaces must have been.
I can tell you that I fought in cages that were, I mean, now you have a little bit of padding and then you have your matted surface.
Right.
I can remember fighting on plywood that was had a tarp over it.
Oh man!
I mean, it was rough. But
yeah, that's like backyard wrestling stuff, man. Wow.
Oh yes. Heck, one of the first places I trained, we didn't have any mats. We had a concrete floor with carpet on it. And we trained there for about a year and a half. Cause, I mean, there was no, like you said, there was no jiu-jitsu schools, and that jiu-jitsu was just being introduced into the United States, really.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I grew up in Freehold, New Jersey, and at the time there was a guy in Red Bank who did jiu-jitsu, but aside from that, there was literally no other schools, and I had to go all the way up to Elizabeth to train in a warehouse environment, which, you know, has similar conditions to what we've been describing. And, you know, we've heard all sorts of craziness from backstage at UFC events. We heard about Waleed trying to fight Tank. We heard about Tank fighting Alon Goez. We also heard about Tank fighting Paul Herrera and then beating up Pat Smith. But, you know, we hear a lot of stories involving Tank that were pretty wild at the time. Does anything stick out for you about your UFC appearances in terms of the craziness of the No Holds Barred era?
I love, you're talking about Tank Abbott. I remember being in Mobile, Alabama with Tank.
Uh-huh.
After fights were over, we had our after-fight party, and then everybody went out. And it was down on what they call Dolphin Street in Mobile. We were in a nightclub there. Tank pulled a chair over by the jukebox they had playing and was sitting in front of it. And he put money in it. He played the music. He wouldn't allow any of the other people in the place to play anything. He was going to listen to what he wanted. And when security at the nightclub approached him, they ended up with three security guards on the floor and two police officers that came in. They got beat up too. Tank got taken out in handcuffs, but he listened to his music.
Wow. Yeah. Oh man.
Yeah.
That sounds like Tank. I mean, having not met him or interviewed him, that definitely sounds like him. I mean, you know. And I wonder to what extent he's still like that. I mean, he does have a family. He was talking about fighting not too long ago, but you wonder how much of that, does he still do stuff like that? You don't hear him getting arrested anymore, but I'm sure he's still got that streak in him.
Oh, yeah. I'm going to tell you that. I'm 48 years old and out of shape, but that's one of the only fighters out there. I was supposed to fight Tank at the Ultimate Japan, at the first Ultimate Japan they had. Right. I was scheduled to fight Tank, and about 6 days before I was scheduled to leave, I was contacted, and my fight was canceled because the Japanese government, the Japanese authorities over there, wanted a Japanese guy to fight Tank, so Yoji Anjo was put in to fight Tank. That's. I always wanted to fight Dan Severn. I got to fight Dan, but Tank was my next one, and that's one that I could be 60 years old and come out to do that one.
Oh, that'd be awesome. That would really
would
be awesome
it.
Because that's a fighting style. You know, I could see, I could see that because that's a fighting style. That's a fighting matchup that makes sense. And like I said,
yeah.
Tank has been willing to fight. He wants to come out and fight, and that would be a great fight. I mean, you remember a couple of years ago, Tank did that fight, that backyard match with Scott Ferozzo. And, you know, I mean, that would be really, really something. So it's good that you're willing to do that, because I'm sure that he'd be willing to do that as well. I can almost guarantee that.
that's my dream right there. Like I said, I could be 60 years old and get myself in shape for that one.
Now, during your first fight, they listed your attributes as size and power, solid groundwork, good striker, few submissions. Was that a fair description of your fighting ability at the time you made your debut?
At that time, yes. Like I said, the only formal training I had was professional wrestling. I mean, I was a brawler. I'd fought all over the place as far as on the streets and in bars, but I had never fought in a cage or in a ring or anything, no. I was a brawler and I was a wrestler. So my first fight, what they listed was me.
Yeah, and that was really, I think I want to talk about your UFC fights, but I remember when you fought Alex Hunter pretty well as a fellow New Jersey resident. I remember that, and they had you, you stepped foot in the cage against him on the biggest show for a fairly new sport. It seemed like you were beating Hunter, but you may have overcommitted to those guillotine attempts, or maybe you tried it too often but didn't fully commit to one attempt. What happened in that fight that you can remember?
I'm going to tell you that when I fought in UFC 17, the referee, Joe, I don't remember his last name. His name was Joe. He was my the referee on my fight in UFC 15. Mm-hmm. He himself told me backstage, he said, I'm going to tell you, he said, you won that fight. He said,
right,
I did not have the, he said, I didn't have the heart. He said, when Alex Hunter first got you on the mat, he said, I didn't have the heart to stand you back up. He said, because the man fought so hard to get you down there. But the problem with it was I gassed out. When we hit that mat, I was, my wind was gone. I was blown out. As far as being hurt, I mean, the man never hit me hard. He didn't hurt me at all. As a matter of fact, when the fight was over, he was taken from the backstage area to the hospital in Bay St. Louis, Mississippi. He was taken to the hospital and spent the day in the hospital. When I had him in the guillotine and I picked him up off the ground by his neck, I damaged his neck. But as far as, I mean, I gassed out. That was the problem there.
Yeah, you were picking him up off the ground with that choke, and it looked like he had his hands inside. Did you ever think about slamming him off that lift? I mean, Blatnick was critical of the lifting tactic because he felt like the choke wasn't in and it used too much energy. But I don't know. Like,
I'm gonna tell you that I thought about slamming him, but you know what the problem was? If you look at when they changed the rules as far as strikes to the back of the head and things you were allowed to do was UFC 15. If you notice, when I was in that, we were in the, up against the cage one time, I looked at the referee because I went to do something and I looked at him. I said, am I allowed to do this? I was so confused because they just changed the rules on me. And 2 days before the event is when I found out there was things we weren't allowed to do. So I didn't know what I was allowed to do at that moment. It tied my hands a lot.
As I mentioned, you know, Blatnick was fairly critical of that. In hindsight, is that a fair assessment that the lifting tactic wasn't really, I guess, useful because the choke wasn't in and it used too much energy? Or did you feel that it was effective? I mean, it did hurt him, but you feel that it was perhaps maybe effective in other ways?
It was effective in other ways, but at the same time, like you're saying, the choke wasn't locked in, and you didn't use a lot of energy. It sure did. I mean, that was my first time ever fighting on a big stage, really. I'd fought small shows. I fought the IFC. That was my first time on television, so my adrenaline was so high that I lost all my energy wasting my time with that choke.
But
trying to get that choke, let me say that.
Sorry. Rest in peace, Jeff Blatnick. He was really, really a very, very key figure in the sport of MMA and wrestling. Did you have any contact with Jeff during your UFC appearances?
Oh, yes. And during the UFC, and then I fought for what they call the ICC in Minneapolis, Minnesota. I spent 3 days up there with Jeff. I actually had dinner with him in a hotel restaurant that we stayed at. Really great guy.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I think I met him years ago in Texas, but everybody really had a lot of respect for him. With your current level of training and experience, I bet you feel like you do things differently in that fight. I mean, how would you use that position with the guillotine now? Maybe more knees, or
I definitely would have used more knees. And I'm going to tell you that at that time, I didn't have any real formal jiu-jitsu training, so I was trying to stay off the ground with him because he was a black belt in Brazilian jiu-jitsu. Now, I would gladly take him to the ground and be able to survive there and probably submit him on the ground. I was nervous about his jiu-jitsu training at that time.
Right.
But definitely more knees.
Yeah, absolutely. And it looked like you did the most damage with knees. I mean, Hunter was getting blasted, and I give him credit for surviving a shot from a guy with your size. I mean, it seemed like Hunter just wanted to hold you down for the latter part of that round, and I guess I don't blame him after those shots. I mean, you showed great takedown defense, especially for the time when you were stuffing the shots, especially given your height and so on. So, you know, he only got the takedown because you went for a no-hooks rear naked that looked pretty deep, but he was able to reverse and get on top. Did you feel the effects of fatigue at that stage? You mentioned it before, but you're a big guy, and you had been throwing about 7 minutes worth of punches without the benefit of modern condition training that we have now.
Yeah, when he finally rolled me onto my back, I was very relieved, to put it lightly. I was relieved to be on my back where I could rest. All I had to do was defend his punches. He got in a full mount, and all I had to do was defend from him hitting me in the head. And like I said, I got hit about 3 or 4 times, but nothing that really hurt me. That's why the referee told me, he said, I didn't have the heart to stand him back up. He said, because the man fought so hard to get you to the ground. He said, I just couldn't do it.
So, yeah, and that's unfortunate.
I was offered, I was in Panama City, Florida, as I stated before, fighting. And Alex Hunter was scheduled to fight on that card. And his opponent had pulled out of it. And they asked me that night if I was willing to fight him again. And I told him, I'll gladly fight him. And he, at that time, he refused the fight. He said that there was no way he was going to fight me at that time, because at that time I had gone on to a strict diet, was training regularly. I was down to 262 pounds. And, I mean, I was in great shape, and he wouldn't take the fight. So,
as a big guy, would you say you're vulnerable to being controlled if an opponent got on top of me? Long legs are more useful for almost anything except standing up fast. I mean, do you feel like your mount escapes were lacking when Hunter was on top?
At that time, yes. At that time, definitely.
Because he didn't do much except maintain that position, so it's hard to make something happen. I know Blatnick said he felt like you were happy to stay in that position. You know, I don't know. How did you take that from Jeff? Did you guess, you know, do you think that was a fair criticism? Or?
Well, that was very fair. From somebody of Jeff's experience and his level of wrestling and everything, I was very happy to stay in that position. I had no wind, no endurance left. I was so tired. I was very happy to be where I was at that time.
Yeah. To me, that fight was really a draw at best. I mean, like the commentator said, he needs to score more, and he didn't land that many shots. And most people didn't think he did enough to win that fight. That was one of those weird fights where even though he won, it really seemed like you beat him up worse. And both commentators stated openly that Hunter wasn't hurting you or doing any damage at all in a fight without judges. It was just Hunter took a lot more damage. There's no question about that. I mean, you had both a takedown. You had 4 submission attempts. You had more strikes than he did. How upset were you at the result?
Oh, I was very upset. I honestly believed I won that fight. If you'll notice at the end of the fight when they made when they announced the decision, I was extremely upset about it. When I got to the dressing room, I felt better. Judo Gene LaBelle approached me in the dressing room and told me, he said, son, you got robbed. He said, you won that fight. He said, you controlled it on the feet. He said, yeah, I fought the man. He said, I don't know why they gave it to him. He said, in my opinion, you won. And coming from somebody like Judo Gene LaBelle, that meant more than the referee announcing me winning.
Yeah, absolutely. And it looked like he didn't fight after that, right? Or is that incorrect? Because I don't have him having fought after he fought you.
No, he never. He, like I said, he was supposed to fight in Panama City, and he didn't fight. And from there, he never fought again. He, I'd heard stories about different things that happened to him, but it's all hearsay about why he never fought. But I mean, for me to say something factually, I really don't know, but I know he never fought again.
Yeah. One strange thing that happened was your sly water drinking during the referee stand-up, and that's something we never see these days, and it may even be a DQ.
Yeah, Yeah, the referee was not happy at all. I wanted some water. When he gave me that time in the corner, I was getting me some water.
Yeah. Well, that was just part of the crazy world no holds barred at the time. I mean, sometimes these things happen in an HB.
Oh, yes. Definitely. I mean, I look at today's sport. It has evolved so much. But as far as if you were to compare NHB against MMA,
right,
I would fight NHB any day. I mean, I would go back to the way it was back then rather than the way it is today, in my opinion. I think it was a whole lot better.
Yeah, well, a lot of people that I know from that era and even outside that era agree. Then you had the Rocks fight, which was a shorter fight and a brawl while it lasted, from what I've heard. And am I right in saying that there is no tape on this fight? I haven't been able to find it anywhere.
There is a tape on it. It was filmed. They filmed that fight, and they filmed Frank Shamrock against Jeremy Horn. Frank defended his belt against Jeremy Horn that night. And both of them weren't aired with UFC 17. I used to have a video of it that I was given by Elaine McCarthy, but I lent it to somebody and I never got it back, and God only knows where it is today.
I see. That would be really, really good to see that, because it's just a lot of people, I haven't been able to see that. I saw the Shamrock and Jeremy Horn fight. That was a very, very famous fight from that era. Did that not make the live broadcast, that fight? I mean, from what I read, you two basically threw bombs at each other until he landed an elbow and knocked you down and the ref stopped the fight. Can you expand on the description of that fight at all?
That fight there, that was, like you said, we threw bombs. We were up against the cage just trading for I don't even know how many minutes. To me, it seemed like it was forever.
Right.
But, I mean, Andre Roberts is a big, big man. And he caught me with an elbow to the side of my temple. When I went down, the referee came over, was checking on me, and he came over the top of the referee and hit me again. That's when the fight was stopped.
Oh, I see.
The referee had ceased all action. And, I mean, I don't believe he did it maliciously. At that time, your adrenaline's pumping. He came up, when the referee stepped in, and he came over the top and caught me with my head against the mat and drove my head into the mat. And that's when it was stopped there. But, I mean, it was a great fight. Do I think I was winning? Yes, I do. But like I said, he caught me with a good elbow, and hats off to him.
Yeah, and I just want to reiterate what you said, because the same play-by-play said that he landed a couple late shots on you as the referee was breaking up. And so that could have definitely been a factor in the fight. And also, coincidentally, Alex Hunter's nickname was the Chief as well. So that's kind of a weird little coincidence there. Was it a personal goal of yours to fight everyone on the roster with that nickname?
You know, I actually fought a guy they called the Chief for the International Fighting Championship. His name was Frank Laughing. I fought him when I stayed in Montreal, Canada. We went into New York. He was part of an Indian tribe up there. He was the Chief, so he was my third.
Wow. Yeah, so that's just that's like incredible. I had no idea about the other Chief. Wow. But you know what? Another interesting thing, too, is both Roberts and Hunter were undefeated when you fought them, so there was no shame in losing to either of them. But was it frustrating for you to have to fight outside the UFC after making it there?
No, not really. Not really. I mean, let me say that when Art Davey had the UFC, if Art Davey had kept the UFC, I would have continued fighting. He brought in a promoter, well, not a promoter, the matchmaker, John Peretti. I don't know if
right.
you're familiar with John.
Yep.
But me and John Peretti had words. And flat out, to my face, he told me, he said, "You will never fight here again," because we had some words with the Andre Roberts fight. And
okay.
that pretty much blackballed me. So I knew my time there was done. I went Monty Cox was affiliated with Rings at that time. He got me a fight with Rings. I was happy. I got nothing that I regret as far as my fight career. My time in the UFC was done. I enjoyed it while it lasted.
Now, you're outside the UFC. One of your more well-known fights was with Travis Fulton. And I want to take a second out to give Fulton props because he has a ridiculous record at least 300 fights. I mean, he's still fighting and winning regularly. And many of his losing probably have as much to do with his conditioning than his actual fighting ability. And he's a special fighter, whatever people think of him on a personal level. What can you tell us about your matches with Fulton and some of the rivalry that existed between the pair of you?
I'm going to be honest, there was no real rivalry. Travis is a great guy. I've never been hit as hard as I've been hit by him. That man, when he hits you, it feels like he's got a hammer in his hand. His nickname is the Hands of Stone and the Iron Man, and it's a legitimate nickname. The man hits hard. First time I fought him, we fought in Evansville, Indiana, and at that time, I'd never fought in a ring. I fought in a cage. In a ring, when we fought in a ring, we fought for hook and shoot in the ring. And top of my head went outside the ring. I was not used to the way they worked that. We were brought back to the center of the ring. I was laid out. They made me lay on my back. They put him in a full mount. The minute they said go, he hit me. This was all new to me. I had never done anything like this before. And when he hit me, when the referee said go, I looked at him. It was over. Second time I fought him, I fought him in St. Louis, Missouri. And it was a much better fight. I can tell you that after the fight, he asked me, he said, let me go back that in between both fights, I had started teaching a kids class. And I found it real hard to teach kids. I found it real hard to separate teaching and fighting. When I was teaching kids, I had to go half speed, half strength, half everything.
Right.
And I found it real hard to separate them. That's why I stopped teaching. And when I fought Travis got me in an armbar. I powered out of it. He got me into like three or four armbars, and I powered out of it. And after the fight, yes, he said, why were you in there playing with me? I said, I wasn't playing. He said, yes, you were. He said, look, he said, you could have ended that fight early. He said, but you kept feeding me that arm and playing with me. And I thought about it, and he was right. I gave him my arm three or four times, and finally he got me in an arm bar, and I had to tap out. So, Travis, matter of fact, he's got a fight coming up. He's getting ready to fight for the Iowa Challenge. This is going to be his last cage fight. And then he's going to go on to doing professional boxing.
Oh, wow. I didn't know that.
Yes, he's getting ready to fight in Iowa. I think it's in Des Moines, Iowa, in the Iowa Challenge.
Now, outside of your best-known fights, which of your other performances did you feel were your best?
My best. I fought for the IFC in Mobile, Alabama, back in the tournament format. I fought three fights that night. My final fight was for the IFC heavyweight title. I ended up losing that fight. But my first two fights was altogether 18 minutes. That was back before they had rounds. It was altogether 18 minutes. I won both of them by knockout. My training was much different. I had trained a lot. My cardio was where it needed to be. I mean, I was on the top of my game. I think if I had been like that throughout my whole career, it probably wouldn't have been a whole lot better, and it would have lasted a whole lot longer. So I believe
most of your losses were by submission. Do you feel that your defense was lacking in some particular area, or is it because of your aggressive grappling style?
Yeah, I believe it was. I believe I know my takedown wasn't my takedown defense was not lacking. Mm-hmm. I was good at defending the takedown. But again, like I said, I found myself when I would get on the ground, I found myself playing with them more because I was training. I was teaching children at that time for about 2 or 3 years. I found myself where I was, like you said, I would get submitted. Mm-hmm. I found myself that I was giving them. I mean, they'd get a hold of my arm, and instead of fighting to get it away, I was feeding it to them because in class with children, I would feed it to them and let them apply it to see so they would know the right way to do it. And I found myself doing that in a lot of fights. That's why I got away from the teaching and everything.
Well, you fought in a wide range of promotions. UFC, of course, Hook and Shoot, Reality Combat, IFC, Rings, and I think, I'm not sure if there's any others, but I bet you had a mixed set of experiences with promoters in terms of honesty and the shows themselves in terms of quality. Is that right?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. The UFC is, I mean, that's the pinnacle of it. There's nothing to worry about there. Your money's always there. You're well taken care of. I fought on shows where I can remember, I've mentioned 2 or 3 times fighting in Panama City.
Mm-hmm.
Right off the top of my head, I don't remember the promoter's name, but I can tell you that when the fights were over and we were all supposed to meet in the dressing room to be paid, after about 15 minutes of waiting for this promoter, somebody went looking for him in the arena, and he was gone. He had already checked out of the hotel. There was no paycheck. There was no paychecks for anybody. I'm going to tell you that I said that night, I said, I think he might be a tougher person than any one of us fighting, either tougher or stupider. Because how do you take, there was 15 fights that night, there's 30 men. How do you take 30 guys willing to get in a cage and put it all on the line and bleed? How do you screw them over knowing that they're coming looking for you?
Yeah, right.
So. Yeah, there's always been some shady, dirty promoters out there.
Did anything ever happen with that promoter? Did you guys ever get your money back?
Never got paid. We were promised a lot. The money's going to be there. I'm waiting for the athletic commission to release that. He had to put like a $25,000 bond with the athletic commission to have the fight sanctioned.
Mm-hmm.
We were told that once that money was released, we would be paid. Actually, I know the state of Florida had put a freeze, the athletic commission had put a freeze on that $25,000 bond because he did not pay anybody. Whether or not he ever got that, I don't know. But I know that to this day, now you're talking 15, 16 years ago, to this day I've never gotten a dime from it.
Wow.
I got a lesson learned. There was a lot of shady, dirty promoters. And I'm going to tell you that they outweighed the good. There was a lot of them. Some of your best promoters are still in the sport. That is the thing. Monty Cox, that's one of the best guys I've ever dealt with as far as fighting goes.
He's done. He's actually going to be running. He ran a show, I think, last month or not too long ago. And he said he's basically done now. He can't. It's very, very difficult for promoters, regional promoters, to do it anymore. And that's it. He's going to be out.
Yeah, I know. Rich No Love Clemente had an organization. He bought the organization I fought for, Reality Combat. He had bought them out. And he was running the show out of Louisiana, and he just sold out because it was getting hard.
Oh wow. That's unfortunate. It really is. So basically, you have this long storied career. You definitely were right in the beginning of the sport, and you really made an impression on a lot of people out there. And when you look back on your career, do you have any doubts? Do you have any regrets, or do you have anything that you wish that you'd done differently?
Definitely do. I wish I had put more into it as far as training the preparation, I believe it would have been a whole lot different for me if I had put more time and effort into it. In the beginning, I put a whole lot into it, and once I reached a certain level, my head got big, and I stopped training the way I should. I stopped eating the way I should. I can remember going to fights and not training at all, going in there thinking right. that I could survive on just the talent that I had at one time, going in there and getting in a cage and in 2 minutes being so tired that I didn't even belong in there.
Mm. But I bet your experiences inside the ring have helped you out in many other ways, right?
Oh, yes. I mean, as far as your experience level, it helps you a lot in other ways. But if you don't have cardio, it don't do nothing. It don't mean anything, really.
Yeah. Well, listen, we really appreciate you coming on the show to kick off 2016 with us, Harry. Like I said, people know your fights. They may not know the man behind it, but hopefully we've been able to give people some insight today as far as who you are and whatnot. And I hope that you do get a chance to fight Tank Abbott. I just posted a thread on the Underground Forum with the title Tank versus Harry Moskowitz. So maybe that'll happen. Maybe that'll get some traction and somebody will pick it up and be able to give the fans that fight in the future. So thanks a lot. We really appreciate it. You are an MMA pioneer, and we hope to talk to you sometime down the road, my friend.
Bob, thank you very much. And I'm going to tell you that if that fight ever does happen, I know one man I want in my corner, and that would be you.
Awesome. It would be an honor. It would definitely be an honor. Two New Jersey natives, it would be great. So thank you very much, Harry. Take care, my friend.
Thank you, sir. You have a good day.
You too. Bye-bye. All right, that was Harry Moskowitz here on Carson's Corner. Yes, that was an awesome interview, man. I got to tell you, we learned a lot about, I love talking to fighters that have been around the sport for a long time that can give you stories and just tell you how things were back in what we could call the dark ages. You know, listening to stories involving Tank or stories involving some of the decrepit training conditions that these fighters had to endure. And it all seems like a magical period of time. You know, and I know people that were around back then. You know, for example, Eddie Goldman, who I was on his show a couple weeks ago. Eddie Goldman was back around those fights. He was around a lot of those old school NHB fighters and whatnot, and he could tell you a lot of stories as well. It's really, I think those days are gone forever now. You know, I think now as the sport has gotten glamorized, as the sport has been commercialized, it's almost not as fun. It's almost not as exciting as it was back in those days. And so, you know, we got to cherish those days. We really do. And that's why we love having people on like Harry Moskowitz. I mean, just in the last couple of years, you know, we've had some old school NHB fighters. We had Fred Edish. You remember Fred Edish? We spoke with him probably back in 2013. We had Taylor Tooley on the program. I may reach out and try to get Paul Varlins on the program. I'm friends with him on Facebook, and it would be really, really good to speak to him as well and get his, you know, some of his experiences in fighting in the UFC and ECW and all of these different promotions and just find out, you know, talk to these guys because, you know, we Eddie and I spoke about the death of Manny Yarborough and how Manny Yarborough, of course, fought in UFC 3, and we really dissected it in a way that most people wouldn't. And it's a shame that Manny Yarborough and others like him who fought in the pre-Zuffa days of the UFC weren't given the attention. You know, we're just basically disregarded by a media, an MMA media culture, which only focuses on the moment. And that's a real, real problem. And so it's shows like this and others that can give people a real feel for how it was back in those days. And I want to thank again Harry for coming on the program. He was great. I really, really enjoyed this interview. We went almost about an hour or so. And I know the fans out there are going to enjoy this as well. All right, we've got UFC 195 getting set to take place in just a few hours. And unfortunately, no, I'm not going to be able to watch this. I have to actually go into work. Can you believe that? But it's true. I have to go to work and work my second job, which I don't do all that often, but it's a per diem job. But it's something that I have to do. And really, there's only two fights that I'm concerned about on this card, which is occurring at the MGM Grand Arena in Las Vegas. And that, of course, is Robbie Lawler versus Carlos Condit. These two were supposed to fight earlier, and Robbie Lawler pulled out, and now they're going to fight again, supposed to fight tonight. And my prediction is I think Robbie Lawler is going to win. I think Robbie Lawler is in the zone, so to speak. He's won four or five fights in a row over really, really top-level competition. He's just really battered his competition, and particularly you go back to the Rory McDonald fight and just how brutal that fight was. And he just doesn't seem like the type of fighter that really anybody that does not have a real strong takedown and wrestling game wants to fight. Now, on the other hand, you know, Carlos Condit, we actually interviewed Carlos about a year ago. And this was right after his fight versus Tyron Woodley, where he got injured, where he suffered that knee injury. He's coming off of a victory in May, looked very, very good against Thiago Alves. And I just think there's a lot more question marks about Carlos Condit at this point than there are about Robbie Lawler. Now, of course, can Carlos defeat Robbie? Does Carlos have the knockout power, particularly in his kicks, to knock out Robbie Lawler? Absolutely. So it wouldn't surprise me if Carlos Condit does win this fight. But I would have to say, you know, based on what we've seen from Robbie Lawler recently, there are less questions about him going into this fight than there are about Carlos Condit. And I think that this is going to be a striking match, which is what these two fighters want, and there's going to be really no takedowns in this fight, and I think that's got to favor Robbie Lawler. Both of these guys have very, very good chins. There's no question about that. Both these guys can take a tremendous amount of punishment. I don't even think that Carlos Condit has lost via knockout. I think all of his losses have been either by decision or by submission, so that really speaks volumes about his chin. And then you look at Robbie Lawler, and Robbie Lawler doesn't really have too many losses by knockouts as well. I mean, he was knocked out, of course, by Nick Diaz years and years ago. I remember that. But other than that, I mean, he really has a solid chin. And so that's going to give the fans a really, really good fight. But if I were a betting man, I'd have to say Robbie Lawler is going to retain his welterweight championship belt tonight, but it should be in entertaining fashion. Now, the other fight that I'm looking forward to that has title implications is the Stipe Miocic versus Andrei Arlovsky fight. Andrei Arlovsky, we know, was written off a few years ago. This is a guy who was fighting in the World Series of Fighting against Mike Kyle, and then he lost. I remember seeing him fight versus Anthony Johnson, and he got his jaw broken, his teeth knocked out. And he just looked bad. I mean, it did not look bad, but it just didn't look like he was going to be able to mount any type of you know, run for the title, and he comes into the UFC. He wins, you know, 4 or 5 fights in very, very impressive fashion. His last fight versus Frank Mir wasn't as impressive, but he got the win. He won decisively. And now, you know, potentially he's, you know, 1 or 2 fights away from the championship, from fighting Fabricio Werdum. And so you've got him versus Stipe Miocic. And Stipe, of course, is coming off of an injury, I believe. He pulled out. These two were supposed to fight earlier in the year, I think in October. And Stipe pulled out, and, you know, he's coming back now. It's been almost 2 months. And we're going to have to see what happens. I'm going to pick Stipe Miocic to win because I think that his stand-up is good enough. And Arlovski, if it's been anything that Arlovski has shown over the course of his career, it is that he is susceptible to the knockout. Okay, there's just no question about that. And I think that Stipe Miocic is the type of fighter that can get in close with Andre Arlovski, and he's the type of fighter that can knock him out. And can Arlovski knock out Stipe Miocic? Absolutely. But if I had to pick, I'm going to say that Stipe is going to be able to use his footwork. He's going to be able to sort of, you know, pick his shots, and he's going to be very, very careful, and he's going to be able to knock Andre Arlovski out. Now, that's not to say that Andre Arlovski is going to be doing the same thing, because we know that Arlovski understands that he has been knocked out a bunch of times before, and he understands that he needs to be more careful. He needs to have more movement while he's in the pocket throwing with these other fighters. So he may look to do that as well. So we could end up seeing a decision here where both fighters are going to respect and recognize each other's power, but they're not going to really commit to any strikes. They're going to be overly careful, and it could make for a decision. We don't know. We're going to have to see. But if I had to bet, I would say that Stipe Miocic is going to win this fight via knockout. That's my predictions. The last card, the UFC 194, I actually did pretty well with my predictions. The only prediction I lost was the Chris Weidman versus Luke Rockhold result. But in any event, I was basically, you know, at 80% for UFC 194. So that's it. We'll see what happens at UFC 195. Look forward to it. And thank you very much for listening. I want to, again, thank Harry Moskowitz for being on the program. We have big things planned, of course, for 2016. Who knows where Carson's Corner will end up in this year. You know, we've been doing this show for 10 years now, okay, and people still recognize the show. People still appreciate the show. Carson's Corner and Bob Carson, we definitely have name recognition, and we're pleased to be still giving you shows 10 years, folks. And in my opinion, we do the best interviews out there. That's really our calling card, is our interviews, because you're just not going to get the level of research. You're not going to get the type of questions and the type of delivery that we have here on Carson's Corner. So I want to thank you for supporting us over the last 10 years. It really, really has been very, very important. So with having said that, thank you very much. Have a happy Saturday night. I hope you enjoy UFC 195, and we'll see you back next time we have a show here on Carson's Corner. Make sure to follow me on Facebook at facebook.com/BobCarsonMMA. You could follow me on Twitter, twitter.com/BobCarsonMMA, and follow us here on Blog Talk Radio, blogtalkradio.com/Carson's Corner. Thank you very much, folks.